Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by Jacob Dunn. Jacob was jailed for manslaughter in 2011, and he talks to us about the transformative effect of restorative justice, especially how meeting his victim's parents completely turned his life around. Hello, Jacob. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, Jacob, well, should we just dive straight in and tell us your story?
Okay. So I'm from the Nottingham area. Currently, I'm 24 years old now. And my childhood growing up wasn't anything out of the ordinary. I came from a loving, stable background, household. And my family unit was made up of me, my little brother, and my mum. My dad left around the age of 7 years old. I don't know how much of a factor that had. That's a question I get asked a lot in hindsight now when I do talks. Was having a father figure, did that play a big role in your life? Me personally, I don't like to do hindsight and what if this and what if that. I just think, you know, you can't gain anything from that. I like to reflect, but sometimes I just see no real, it's a waste of effort looking at some of those external factors I had and don't have any control over. And so I grew up, went through primary school, everything was fine, got into secondary school, and I started to experience some kind of behavioural issues and behavioural problems. And at first, I didn't really think anything of it. It was just struggling to concentrate in class. And I think as well, that transition from primary school to secondary school, it was like in primary school, when I think about it now, it's a lot more creative. It's a lot more flexible, not as many boundaries and rules, not as authoritarian either. And I think I kind of struggled with that adjustment, as many young people probably do.
I think I did.
Yeah. And, so I just used to disobey, talk when I'm not supposed to talk, little things like that. And it just kind of escalated. I ended up becoming the class clown, playing up to that role of, you know, making everyone laugh and getting in trouble, running around the school, skiving and stuff. And just kind of losing any sense of what it means to be in education. I'd lost the message of education. I didn't know why I was there. I wasn't there to learn or grow as a person. I know these are kind of like quite deep and complex things that we're talking about now. And I don't know whether we think that deeply as a young, you know, 13, 14 year old. But that kind of message of why I'm in school was lost. It was, oh, you're here to get a good job. And that's it. So it was just a pure economic reason for being in school. Yeah. And I didn't feel like I could gain anything from school. And so I quickly fell behind in my classes, ended up getting put in the bottom sets. And that kind of had quite a big impact on my self-esteem. And, you know, how I internalized that was I then began to feel like I wasn't intelligent. I began to feel as a young person that, you know, I was, the words that the teachers used at that time was thick. And that was a recipe for disaster, really, because as humans, what do? We make friends with people we have things in common with. And so in my local community, in the city of Nottingham, that we have quite a lot of trouble with gang culture. And, you know, generations after generations drop out of school. At the time, it felt like a safe place, hanging around with other people that had dropped out of school and who you were kind of marginalized from the mainstream society. And so I got kicked out of two schools eventually, for, you know, all sorts of things, you know, selling drugs in school and all sorts of stuff like that. And I was kind of lost. That's the only, when I look back at that time, someone says, what kind of person was you then? I'd say lost, because I didn't have any drive, didn't have any aspirations for my own life. I didn't have any goals. I didn't have any self-worth. And it was a difficult time. And when you're in that space, that's when you can quickly develop a gang mindset and kind of negative values, which is what I talk about a lot in schools now, negative values and negative beliefs. So I began, you know, very masculine beliefs such as you've always got to have your friends' backs. So what I mean by that is, you know, we were always thinking aggressively, and that if one of our friends got in trouble, we'd have to be there to support them, but in a violent way. Mm-hmm. Or we used to look at authority in terms of the police. When I was in school, the authority was the teachers, and we used to rebel against the teachers. Then by the time we'd grown up a little bit, the new authority, the new enemy, you know, was the police. When I look back at it now, you don't think it at the time, but you know, it's almost like everyone else is against you.
Yeah.
And the only people that you can really relate to are those, your peers that are in your situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I then got heavily started to use drug and alcohol. We started to misuse drug and alcohol from an early age. And with those underlying kind of beliefs now that I've started to develop, and such lack of, you know, self-worth as well, ultimately suppose a bit of a recipe for disaster, really. And started to associate alcohol with violence, and going out with my friends into the city centre, getting into trouble with other groups of lads from other areas, and yeah, just getting into fights. And that all became normalised. You know, I study criminology now, and the first thing we learn when we study crime is a social construct. So, you know, what's crime? What is a crime to me, you know, might not be a crime to you. And, you know, back then when I was reflecting on it, these kind of behaviours were normal. You know, they become normalised, and it was perfectly acceptable within our group, within our community, that these behaviours were okay.
Yeah.
And when you're continually doing that, continually making poor decisions, eventually something really bad's going to happen. And this is something I say in schools now to a lot of young people, is it's kind of glorified in a lot of degree with, you know, current urban culture, rap culture, you know, this certain lifestyle to some young people growing up is glorified.
Mm-hmm.
But what I try to put on my talks is the reality of this lifestyle is that it only ever ends in negative. You know, there's not many people that live that lifestyle and go on to live a happy and successful life. You know, most people end up either going to prison, getting seriously hurt, you know, or their families getting seriously hurt, whether, you know, physically or, you know, emotionally. And so that's what happened to me. Eventually, all my relationships broke down around me, and it came to a specific night in 2011, 31st. Of July, and I was out celebrating a friend's birthday, and he was 18 at the time, I was 19, and we'd been out drinking all day, you know, under the influence of drug and alcohol, and it was, you know, like I said before, going out, you know, almost expecting fights to happen.
Yeah.
And towards the end of that night, I lost my friends. And to, you know, cut a bit of a long story short, by the end of that night, my friends called me and said, there's something's kicking off. There's an altercation occurring between two groups of people. And me being me back then, I went running down there, you know, with the intention to support my friends, and ended up getting involved in a violent way, throwing a single punch that led to that man falling unconscious on the floor. And then you fast forward a month later from that punch, the police came and raided all my friends, and I went and handed myself into the police station. And that's that. Then a month after that punch was the first time I found out that that man had passed away. And yeah, that was the worst day of my life, really.
So what was the reaction? Just shock? Or how?
It was just complete, utter shock. To think that, you know, I threw a single punch and that person had died,
mm-hmm.
Was, kind of, it was just like everything was a blur. Everything went into slow motion, and I was just confused and shocked. And I, and but the sad thing is, I had this kind of realization at that moment where I almost developed some self-worth again, because I realized this isn't what I wanted for my life. You know, I wanted more than this for my life, because at that moment I felt like that was it was over. You know, that I was arrested for murder, and at that time it was murder, and you know, my whole life had fallen apart. Everything had fallen apart at that time. I thought, this is it, this is over. And and as a young 19-year-old sitting in that prison cell, it was a horrible place. But I had this realization that I wanted a bit more for my life than that.
So the mist sort of cleared in a way that you suddenly saw.
Yeah, things started to become a bit clear. Things started to become a bit clearer. And it's funny that, you know, it takes very traumatic experiences in our lives often for things to be put back into perspective. And to realize what's really important. So the first things that started coming to my mind were, you know, how am I going to tell my mum this? Because at the end of the day, I only ever wanted to make her proud, and all I'd ever been doing up until this point is, you know, letting her down and getting kicked out of schools and stuff. And now this, you know, how could I ever bring myself to tell my mum that I'd done this? At this point in time, I was still quite a selfish person, so I wasn't really thinking about those who had harmed. I wasn't trying to come to terms with, you know, what I'd actually done and the reality of that. I was more kind of thinking selfishly about myself and, you know, maybe how I could get out of the situation, or, you know, just pure shock.
Yeah.
And feeling sorry for myself as well, in a way. And so what ended up happening is the charges got dropped in manslaughter, and I pleaded guilty. One thing to add, which is quite important here, is when I talk about my life and my past, I don't say any of that to make excuses for my actions. You know, I've totally taken responsibility now, which is just important because I've completely changed my, you know, my complete frame of mind as a person.
Yeah.
So it's important to set a picture of how I became the person that did that to how I've now got to where I am now.
Well, that's definitely coming across.
And so what was important at this point as well is I had that moment of realization where, you know, I realized I had a bit of self-worth, because at this point I was very low self-esteem, didn't really have any kind of self-worth.
Yeah.
But the reason that my solicitors asked me to plead guilty was that all of my friends that were there on that night had wrote statements against me. Now, that might not seem out of the ordinary to, you know, the average person now, that or one of the listeners that were listening to this podcast. But for me and the culture that I was living in, I used to treat my friends back then with more respect and love than I did my own family, because I used to believe, I fully believed that they were the only ones that really understood me, you know, and they were the really only ones, you know, that really got me. And so that was really heartbreaking.
Yeah, so a sense of betrayal.
And so now I've gone to court. And what that kind of led to was me feeling even more sorry for myself, and keep feeling like, you know, I was almost a victim in all of this. And so then I've got sentenced to 2.5 years. Now, we could talk about sentencing for this kind of stuff, and there's a debate going on at the moment. Do I think that 2.5 years was long enough? Probably not. But at the same time, I think everything's worked itself out for me. So I think that being in prison longer would have been more damaging. And I'll go on to talk about that now. Because when I went into custody, with this feeling like I was a victim, you know, a long way away from taking responsibility, because that's what we really want people to do in prisons, is for them to take responsibility for their actions and start to try and change their lives. And trying to become a meaningful member of society. But I was going into prison far away from taking responsibility, feeling like I was the one that was hard done by. And, you know, then I've been put into an institution where you're stripped of all responsibility. So, you know, I went in there, and the most complex decisions you make in a day in prison is, you know, whether you can maybe go to gym or not, or what meal you're going to select off a menu,
Yeah.
or what shower gel you're going to order, or who you're going to call. That's kind of as complex as your decision-making skills go in a prison environment. You're told when to wake up, you're told when you can leave your cell, you're told when to go to sleep, when to eat your meals. So you're kind of stripped of all responsibility. So I've gone in there, and I'm not blaming that institution, because I feel that everyone has to take responsibility themselves, and they can't look for other. As long as you're looking for excuses not to take responsibility, you're never going to take responsibility.
Yeah, but then isn't the, in a sense, the deprivement of your freedom the punishment? But then once you're in there, as you say, shouldn't all the efforts be made then to actually re-engage you or that person with society again, and so they feel part of it? But it seems the opposite in many ways.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I only mentioned that point about response. The institution itself strips you of all responsibility, but the purpose of that institution is for you to take responsibility. And so it's a kind of funny contradiction.
Yeah.
And then what you add on top of that is, as much as we like to think we're independent, of our thoughts, and to a degree, you can train yourself to be very independent. But we're social creatures. We all need, to be liked, or by other people, or
Yeah.
we need to have friends and stuff, So no matter how much we, like I say, think that we're independent, we still rely heavily on those around us. And for some of us that have happy, fulfilled lives, we have happy, fulfilled friends or family, and we have some sense of positive relationships. And it's important to have those positive relationships to have a positive life. That's something I've identified with since coming out of custody. But when you're in a prison environment, there's not a lot of positive people in there. There's a lot of people, feeling sorry for themselves. There's a lot of people feeling hard done by. There's a lot of people with negative beliefs and views of the world and themselves. And so it's hard to try and, find a little spaces of positivity in there
Yeah.
to hold on to.
Is there a lot of distrust as well within the prisoners themselves because of that environment, or do real friendships develop in there?
I think real friendships do develop in there, but it can be hard to break down those barriers, initially, to get to a place where you can be vulnerable.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing, I think, is that prison environments don't allow you to be vulnerable. And if you can't be vulnerable and really, be honest with yourself, you can never really make meaningful change.
Yeah.
And so when I would share my story with the other prisoners, they would reinforce my negative beliefs, and they would reinforce my negative ways of thinking. So kind of, especially in a Young Offenders Institute where I was in Glenparva, the culture within Young Offenders Institute might be slightly different to adults prison, but it seemed to me in that time that I was there, we all kind of reinforced each other's negative beliefs and values, and the things that were all getting us into trouble in the first place. And so I just became more and more bitter, became more and more angry at my friends, became more and more angry at everybody else, at society, and never really looked within throughout that whole time in custody. And so by the time I came out, I was worse than when I went in, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay, so you got out and you say you're in a worse frame of mind than when you went in, and was your life unraveling in some way as well? Because I think you ended up being homeless for a while, didn't you?
I came out with no fixed address, no access to benefits. Couldn't even apply for a job seeker's allowance because of, my personal circumstances at the time.
Yeah.
And so, just complete, you can't really get in a much of a worse situation. On top of that, I've got no qualifications because I fell out of school. I've got no kind of personal skills in terms of, even being confident enough to sit in a interview, and conduct myself in a, positive way.
And presumably, you didn't even have that group to fall back on because of that sense of betrayal.
So then I didn't really feel like I had anywhere to go.
Yeah.
You know, I felt completely misplaced. I didn't even feel safe within, you know, my community and the kind of borderline gang that I was in. But then I've kind of lost my way in any other kind of place that I've been in, so whether it be school, you know, family or whatever. So completely feel lost is probably the best word to use.
Yeah.
And so for those first couple of months that I was out of custody, I was very fortunate not to go back into custody. I was just got by without somehow getting into any trouble. And then the, you know, probably best day of my life, really, thinking about it, was the day I went for a routine appointment to see my probation officer, and she asked me whether I'd ever heard of restorative justice before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had no idea of what it was. I said, no, what is it? And she went on to explain what restorative justice was, and that the mum and dad of the man who had passed away that I hit wanted to contact me.
Just for the benefit of any listeners who are not familiar with restorative justice, roughly what is it?
Restorative justice, when we're talking about it in a criminal justice sense, is where you bring those that have been harmed by a crime together, either to meet or to communicate with the person that's harmed them. And a lot of the time, our criminal justice system has a bad habit of not answering those who have been harmed by crimes questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of the time people want to know, why did you burgle my house? Or why did you do what you did? Why did you graffiti my wall? Why did you hit my son? And a lot of the time the criminal justice system, the police come in, they arrest the person responsible for whatever act of crime. They go through the court and penal system, and none of those questions ever get answered. You're almost like, okay, don't worry, we've caught the bad guy. We're going to deal with him now. And then it almost leaves that person who's been harmed to kind of just deal with whatever has happened to them.
Yeah, in limbo.
Without ever getting any answers. And so what restorative justice offers is that opportunity for those that have been harmed by crime to put those questions to whoever's harmed them, and facilitate that within a safe environment.
And then those people who have been responsible for crime and the ones that are at the receiving end, am I right in saying with restorative justice that there often can be a meeting?
Yeah, they often can be a meeting. And sometimes it depends on how comfortable both parties feel. It's something that has to be voluntarily done from both sides.
Yeah.
You can't really force restorative justice on anyone. It has to be something that both parties go into voluntarily.
Okay, so back to your situation. So the parents of James, they contacted you. So how did that make you feel?
It completely knocked me for six. You know, I was just sat there thinking, oh wow, I'm not the center of all this. I'm not the one who's hurting the most in this situation. There's people out there who have been harmed by this more than me, mm-hmm. and I've not even been thinking about them. And so I went away. I said I'd think about taking part in it. And I came to the decision that the least that I could do was answer some of their questions and try and move on with my life. I didn't think that it could benefit me in any way. But I felt like the least that I could do was answer some of their questions, fill in some of the gaps, or, you know, try and answer as many questions as I could for them to give them a bit of peace of mind. And then move on. I didn't think that I'd be reformed, or, you know, this process would help me in any way. And we didn't feel comfortable meeting face to face either. So an organization called Remedy facilitated our and mediated our conversations.
Yeah.
And so they came to me with Joan and David's questions. And then, but not just their questions, it was the opportunity for them to express how they've been hurting, or, you know, how all of this has impacted on their lives. And so I had to hear some really difficult things, like what it was like for them to sit by their son's bedside life support machine and, you know, have to come to the decision to turn off the life support machine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, talk to me about the funeral arrangements, and talk to me about, James and his personality and, making him a real person. Because, I'd never really thought about that, and I just put that to the back of my mind. I didn't want to confront that. But, through this process, as it, they were able to make me confront those
Yeah.
things.
Did they also express how they felt about you during this process?
It came across within their questioning and then how they felt, because, up until that point, I'd never experienced loss or, ever experienced death of anyone close to me. And so I was hearing it all from the, and there was a lot of frustration, and there was a lot of anger, but there was also a lot of sadness and, a mixture of emotions, as anyone knows, when you lose someone, it's a whirlwind of emotions, never mind when, someone's responsible for that as well. And so I was just being overwhelmed, I was remorseful, I felt shameful, I felt guilt, and these words that I'm saying now, these aren't positive words.
No.
Feeling shameful and guilty, if you get stuck in a state of guilt and shame, that can be just as damaging in itself in terms of hindering change. But it was a positive thing for me at that time, because I needed to hear those things. I needed to feel guilty in order to start looking at myself. And I remember speaking to someone about the word curiosity. What it made me do is it made me curious of myself. Them coming to me and saying, "This is how you've made us feel. Look at all this damage that you've caused." It made me, start to, they questioned me, but by them questioning me, it made me question myself. And it made me, start to assess everything, how I'd been thinking, everything that had happened to me in the past, and really start to come to terms, and start to try and put those hard questions to myself and be honest with myself as well.
So you started challenging all those assumptions that you had, all those negative values you were talking about earlier on.
Yeah, and why I was making all those poor decisions, inevitably. And I spoke with David and Joan over the course of 2.5 years through mediation and through letters. And as our understanding of each other, I guess is the right way to put it, developed, and we gained a bit more of a relationship, I made the decision that, I didn't want to keep living that life. I didn't want to harm any other people. I didn't want to make anybody else ever have to feel that way. And they asked that question as well. After they expressed themselves and was able to, get everything that they needed to say off their chest, they then started to ask me, "Jacob, what are you going to do with your life? What are you going to do with your life, Jacob? Because we don't want you to carry on living that same life." And this is then comes into that word justice. Restorative, the word restorative is kind of like a healing word, it's to restore something. But when you tie those two words together, now you kind of becomes a bit more clear what it is. Restorative justice is, is the justice in healing harm, and from both sides, really, in a way. And that might not be everyone's intentions when they first go into it, but it has a funny way of doing that. Because when two people sit down and have a real conversation, and you find the humanity within each other, and you find the compassion within each other, and that's something that I'd lost.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to reflect on how I'm getting to understand restorative justice. So in some ways it's, when you get the two parties together, for the person responsible for the crime, they in many ways have an opportunity to see perhaps for the first time that the real consequences of their actions. But also from the other way, I'm sure from if you are at the receiving end of crime, it's very easy to actually have a very blinkered sort of cardboard cutout view of the perpetrator, whereas they can actually see that that person is a human being and is vulnerable and fallible and.
And maybe isn't that that monster that you'd ruminated over in your mind constantly, and so it just strips back all the preconceptions everyone has, and really gets down to the truth. And that word that I use, humanity, it really kind of connects two people that in any other walk of life, you know, you wouldn't expect them to talk. You know,
exactly.
They're the last people that you'd think about putting together.
Yeah.
But you know, when they do, in a lot of cases, the benefits for both parties can be seen. And statistically, 85% of victims of crime that have took part in restorative justice have been satisfied with taking part.
And also, crucially, this is not about avoiding a responsibility. It's actually assuming responsibility on both parties. Yeah, no, it sounds very powerful. Anyway, carry on, sorry.
And so, yeah, that when they put that question to me, so what are you going to do with your life now? I was just took back again. So, you know, initially I was took back with how much harm I'd caused and, you know, how guilty I felt. But then I was took back again at that they even cared about me. So we'd had this initial conversation and we got to know each other. And then for them to, you know, ask, what are you going to do with your life? I was took back again. I was like, wow, you know, how can these people even care about, you know, me and my life and, you know, what I'm doing with my life? And then, you know, I said, look, I can't say the word sorry, you know, but what I am going to do is I'm going to prove through my actions that I'm sorry. And I said, what I'm going to do with my life is I'm going to go back into education. I'm going to have another shot at it. And one thing I haven't mentioned yet is that I suffered with dyslexia and ADHD. I was diagnosed with those in school. And I used to think of those as labels that defined me.
Yeah.
And almost as excuses as to why I couldn't achieve in terms of academically. And so the second time round, going back into college, I studied maths, English and psychology. I think psychology was an interesting topic, which helped in itself, because the study of one's mind and the brain and how we think, you know, and I was at a stage in my life where I was changing my way of thinking in my mind. So it kind of complemented where I was at studying psychology at that time.
That makes sense.
But I ended up coming out with an A star in psychology, an A star in English, and a C in maths.
Fantastic. You after know, all that. Yeah.
After all that, yeah. And I was like, wow. You know, I felt like running back to my school and saying, you know what, I was capable. You know, I could do it all along. I just gave up in a way on myself, and it led to a spiral effect, a downward spiral. And then I went on and did a access to social sciences course where I did psychology again at level 3, equivalent to A level. Sociology as well, which I think complemented where I was at, because I was now looking at society. I was looking at my role and how to, thinking of words of like citizenship, you know, and thinking of myself as part of something, as part of a community. I think that's important, because if people are going to no longer commit harm to our communities, they need to feel part of our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time when you put someone in a prison environment, or, you know, they've got to a point where they no longer care about themselves. So why are they going to care about anybody else? You know, never mind our communities. So I know it's very hard to sit here and say that all of us should welcome people coming out of prison back into our communities. But if we do continue to stick, I'm not saying we should welcome them and give them an easy ride, you know, but if we could at least facilitate or try to challenge these stigmas that we attach to people who have offended in the past, because I will forever, you know, in the eyes of law, be an ex-offender. That defines me, you know, and, you know, it follows me around whenever I apply for a job and I have to tick on that box, I've got a criminal record, or, you know, so there are stigmas and things that kind of hold people back. But I do feel that if people are going to contribute meaningfully to our society, they need to feel a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And prison in itself is an institution that nobody knows what happens. It's a part of our society that's the most closed off. No one knows what happens there. You know, it's just like a wall in the middle of a field, out in the countryside somewhere, and no one cares what happens there.
Yeah. Okay. So you went to uni, and then eventually you met with David and Joan. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. So it was after studying my access course. I finished the access course, and then I got my place at university studying criminology. And that was when we all felt comfortable meeting for the first time. And I've got to say, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. Uh-huh. Having to walk into, you know, walking into that room and sitting there, looking them in the eye, you know, and being able to tell them how sorry I was, and to listen to, you know, to them again, because they wanted to say what they said initially. They wanted to say it to my face, wanted to say, make sure that they could look at me and tell me how everything would impact them and the harm that had been caused to them. And likewise, I wanted to look at them in the eye and tell them how sorry. But it was harder than prison, you know, much, much harder, you know, to sit in that room for an hour and mm-hmm. speak than to do nearly a year and a half in custody. But at the same time, I felt relieved afterwards. I felt like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders when I came out of that room. And at the end of that conversation, we agreed that we would continue to work together to spread a message.
Fantastic.
That one punch can kill. And so we went on and we've done documentaries for ITV and Channel 5 since then around this issue of one punch can kill, and also to promote restorative justice as an option for other people. We know that's not going to be right for everyone, but it clearly could help a lot of people try and heal from whatever's happened to them and to try and move on in a more positive way. And also, as well, just a challenge to try and make, you know, I know it sounds, what's the word? I just want to kind of leave a more peaceful world than the one that I left behind when I decided to change.
Yeah.
And so I talk about, you know, masculine culture, peer pressure, all these things that we've talked about today. I talk to in a lot more depth within schools, within prisons now, within universities, to, you know, trainee social workers, anyone that's going to be coming into contact with, you know, a young Jacob or, you know, yeah. or anybody else, just to try and repair some of the harm, I guess.
And what is the response that you normally get?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. I've had a couple of people say some negative things, but for me, I can share my story with confidence because I have the blessing of David and Joe. I wouldn't share my story in the context that I do without their blessing. And so there's this saying that the people that I hurt the most are the ones that have judged me the least.
Yeah.
And if they can't judge me and they can encourage me to go forward and do what I'm doing, then nobody else's opinion really matters.
Can you feel compassion, though, potentially for people? You know, there will maybe some people listening to this who potentially have had their lives badly affected by the effects of crime, who perhaps don't feel that you warrant the positive attention. Can you relate to that at all, or how do you feel about that?
It's a difficult one. I can be empathetic with anyone that's been harmed by crime, because, you know, I've had to hear firsthand how much it does impact someone.
Yeah.
But to kind of demonize or, you know, say that I can't talk because of someone else's experience of crime, it's more kind of a reflection of their problems and not mine. And so, you know, that shouldn't, what someone else's conflict with what's happened to them shouldn't warrant what's happening to me. I feel like I'm a minority in terms of I'm someone that's come out of prison and try and become a positive member of our society now. And, you know, and if we can get more people to make that change, it's going to reduce the amount of victims for other, you know, more people, less people will get harmed in the long run. So,
that makes sense, Jacob. Okay, just coming to my last question. The middle way, as we understand it in our society, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things. That then throws us perhaps back on experience, so we're left in this sort of messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we can actually start to get to grips more adequately with whatever we encounter. Now, recently, I was looking on your Twitter page. You tweeted something. I think it was, when we harden ourselves, we create conditions for little to get in, but we are all a crack away from humanity. Does that sentiment in some way express a similar understanding?
Yes, most definitely. One thing I would say, when I first took part in restorative justice and when I reflect back now, I think about that moment as a period of enlightenment, you know, as a moment where, because my Twitter handle was Jacob Freeman. And you may think, you know, it's free man in terms of liberally free.
Yeah,
you know, I have my freedom, but I see it as I've become mentally free and emotionally free from the rigid fixed views that I once had before, that of a gang culture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it kind of hits the nail on the head there. I'd, you know, took everything as fact, you know, back then. I'd you know, I was too heavily influenced by a set of rigid views that I had formed as a youngster, and that never really led to a lot of bad and poor decisions.
Yeah.
But what I'd done to justify, you know, who I was, and because when you have very fixed subjective views of the world and yourself, you fear change or you fear the unknown. My coping mechanism of that, and criticism and other people, you know, that I couldn't relate to, was to build up a wall of anger. And so my own insecurities and my own vulnerabilities were covered in a layer of anger and violence. And that was fundamentally really through a lack of understanding, which was caused through fixed and rigid mind frame. That kind of goes hand in hand with the middle way, really, and that kind of that viewpoint.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing your incredibly moving and powerful story, Jacob. For me personally, it's been inspirational. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.